Hello, this is Brian Cam, and you are listening to Clear Story, an audio experiment in which I speak off the cuff about writing and topics related to writing, and in which I read to you from a piece of prose and a piece of poetry, which I will be discussing. The first reading I'm going to do is from a rather difficult to find book called A Companion to Angus C. Graham's Dzwanza. And if you're wondering who or what is Dzwanza, you are not alone, which is partly because he is an ancient Chinese philosopher, and partly because his name, like many other Chinese philosophers, has various spellings, at least in English. So I think Wikipedia lists like 8 or 9 different spellings, and I'm just going to give you 2. So on this book, Angus C. Graham, or A.C. Graham, typically spells it C-H-U-A-N-G, and then T-Z-U, or T-Z-U. The other more recent way that it's spelled is Z-H-U-A-N-G-Z-I. As an American in Britain, I never quite know whether I'm supposed to say Z or Z anymore. So you got a mix there, basically. And so these are different romanizations of the same man's name, and he probably lived in the 4th century BC, which is after Confucius by a few hundred years, and also probably after Laozi. And the reason the timeline is a little bit confusing is that much of the writing about Laozi makes it sound like he's a contemporary of Confucius's. So they're having dialogues together, they are debating each other, and the same goes actually for Dzwanza. So even though Dzwanza is the third of these 3 Chinese philosophers, Dzwanza is often presented as a contemporary of Confucius's, even in the book that is named after him, which is just the Dzwanza. So how do these 3 relate? Confucius is known as a sage both under Confucianism and under what's called Taoism. And the 2 later figures, Laozi and Dzwanza, are 2 of the major thinkers in Taoism. Now, just to confuse things further, the Tao, which is usually translated as the way in English, which can both mean like an actual path, a physical path, but also a way of being or a way things are. And that concept of the Tao is also part of Confucianism. Confucianism is a fairly hierarchical structure. It's concerned with things like filial piety, how to behave towards your family, towards your community, and it lays down fairly rigid hierarchies for how the world should operate. It's an orderly world under Confucius. That's my radical simplification, because although I have read Confucius, it has been almost 20 years since I've looked at his writings. So any summary I would give of Confucius is likely to be basic at best and outright misleading at worst. Taoism, on the other hand, I have been somewhat more engaged with. So if you know one book in the Taoist tradition, that will probably be the Tao Te Ching, which is also variously written, but you can find the basic text with T-A-O, T-E, C-H-I-N-G. And I'll link to all of these in the show notes. That translates to the classic of the way and virtue, or sometimes day is translated as power. Dao is almost always translated as way. So, and Jing just means the classic of. You might also recognize that from the I Ching, which just means the book of changes or the classic of changes. And so in contrast to Confucianism, Taoism is very anti-hierarchical. It is anarchic. It is opposed to categorization. At times it's opposed even to language and to rationality. So it is a bit of an odd philosophy. It's almost like an anti-philosophy. And its classic, which is the Tao Te Ching, is pretty much a piece of poetry. I think it's 5,000 characters long. It's sometimes called the classic of 5,000 characters. It rhymes often. It's quite opaque and just a really interesting piece of writing. The Zhuangzi, which comes later, is a mix of things. Parts of it are poetry, parts of it are more prose-like, at least that's what it seems like from the translations that I've read. And it is a bit of a, I wouldn't say quite a commentary on the Tao Te Ching, although it does sometimes quote the Tao Te Ching. But the Zhuangzi is very much its own thing. And I want to suggest following A.C. Graham, one of his main translators, Zhuangzi's main translators, that one of the ways that it's so unique and so very much its own thing is that it is very clearly written by a single man grappling with some of the biggest questions and failing to get a grip on them. This is not unique in ancient literature, and there are other examples. The Book of Job would be another one that comes to mind, but it is very different from the Tao Te Ching, for example, in the same way that Job is very different from the Book of Genesis. The Book of Genesis feels like this kind of timeless, really ancient wisdom document that was probably compiled from this oral tradition, and it just does not read like the kind of thing that you would hear someone say in conversation. And in a similar way, the Tao Te Ching feels this way in comparison with Zhuangzi. Now, what's kind of interesting about that is that they're not actually separated by all that much time. So I will just read to you from first the Tao Te Ching and then maybe bits of Zhuangzi, and you'll get a bit of a flavor of how they differ over the course of just 100 or 200 years. Now, the Tao Te Ching is also one of the most translated books of all time, as far as I know, in part probably because it's so short, and in part because it's so mysterious that it just tantalizes you. I completely understand the feeling of that many of these translators must have had in thinking that they may have had something to contribute to the understanding of the Tao Te Ching, just having read other translations. It is inherently mysterious, and we'll talk about that a little bit more as we get into the commentary on Zhuangzi. But I'm going to give you two different renderings of the opening of the Tao. And the first one captures some of its terseness because it is famously short in such a way that you can't even piece together the sentence structure sometimes. And the second one will give you an idea of how these things are not just rendered, but also interpreted in English. So here is the first reading of the Tao Te Ching. And this is a translation by Stephen Addis and Stanley Lombardo in 1993 that tries to preserve how strangely terse it all is. And this is the very first book, page, chapter. The Tao Te Ching is split into 81 sections. They're often called chapters, even though they're, as you'll hear, they're not really chapter length as we typically think of them. So here is Tao 1 by Addis and Lombardo. Tao called Tao is not Tao. Names can name no lasting name. Nameless, the origin of heaven and earth. Naming, the mother of 10,000 things, empty of desire, perceive mystery, filled with desire, perceive manifestations. These can have the same source, but different names. Call them both deep, deep and again deep, the gateway to all mystery. Now, this next one is by Derek Lynn, a year later in 1994, and this is a much more typical translation of the incredibly mysterious opening of the Tao Te Ching. The Tao that can be spoken is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The nameless is the origin of heaven and earth. The named is the mother of myriad things. Thus, constantly free of desire, one observes its wonders. Constantly filled with desire, one observes its manifestations. These two emerge together, but differ in name. The unity is said to be the mystery. Mystery of mysteries, the door to all wonders. So you can already detect some of the strangeness of Taoism, because it's basically saying that the Tao that can be spoken of is not the Tao we're talking about. And this is a play on words, because Tao also, as I understand it, is the verb to speak. So there's Tao, Tao, Tao in this first opening. Basically saying, the way that you can talk about is not the way, not the constant way or the eternal way. Now, just a few hundred years later, I'm going to read to you from someone else who is in this same school called Taoism. It's worth bearing in mind that the whole concept of a school called Taoism was not really solidified until about the 2nd century AD, I believe. So traditionally, you've got Laozi in the 6th century BC, although the oldest parts of the Tao Te Ching really seem to date to about the 4th century BC. And then you've got 100 or maybe a few hundred years later at most, but probably more like less than a century, you have Zhuangzi writing. Then several hundred years after him, you have the solidification of this concept that they are part of the same school and that this school is different from Confucianism. Both Confucianism and these Taoist thinkers that I'm talking about came from this period called the Hundred Schools of Thought, which lasted from the 6th century to 221 BC in China, which covered two periods, which are called the Spring and Autumn period and the Warring States period. And as I understand it, in 221 BC, a lot of these texts were burned. So although Confucianism and Taoism remained, many of the other ones were purged, and so we don't have a great record of what these other 98 schools were. I'm sure it wasn't exactly 100, but you get the idea. So we have the Tao saying that the Tao that can be spoken of is not the real Tao. Here's Zhuangzi, maybe 100, maybe 200 years later. And he writes, saying is not blowing breath. Saying says something. The only trouble is that what it says is never fixed. Do we really say something? Or have we never said anything? If you think it is different from the twitter of fledglings, is there proof of the distinction? Or isn't there any proof? By what is the way hidden, that there should be a genuine or a false? By what is saying darkened, that sometimes that's it, and sometimes that's not? Wherever we walk, how can the way be absent? Whatever the standpoint, how can saying be unallowable? The way is hidden by a transformation of the lesser. Saying is darkened by its foliage and flowers. And so we have the that's it, that's not of Confucians and Moists, by which what is it for one of them, for the other is not. What is not for one of them, for the other is. If you wish to affirm what they deny and deny what they affirm, the best means is illumination. And so you can hear that Zhuangzi is much closer to how we might speak today about the shortcomings of language and whether we can ever come to any kind of ground truth, even though both he and Laozi are essentially writing about this problem of language. Now, both of these are translations of very difficult and very fragmentary ancient Chinese texts. And the translation I've just read to you from the Zhuangzi is by this guy A.C. Graham, whom I love, both as a translator of Zhuangzi and as a writer in his own right. And so, as I mentioned at the beginning, this is a book called A Companion to Angus C. Graham's Zhuangzi. And the name on the cover is Harold D. Roth, R-O-T-H, who compiled it. What I'm going to read to you is from an essay called Two Notes on the Translation of Taoist Classics. And this is A.C. Graham writing about the problems of translating the Laozi, who's the writer of the Tao Te Ching. And he's writing about Witter Binner's version of Laozi. There are many kinds of translation, one extreme of which is that of the litterateur, working at second hand on the drafts or published versions of others. There have been successful examples in Chinese poetry, notably Ezra Pound's Cathay, from which every subsequent translator has learned directly or indirectly. Since Laozi is a philosophical poem or poem cycle, is there anything a scholarly translator can learn from a version such as Witter Binner's The Way of Life According to Laozi? The answer, I think, is no, but there is something to be learned from considering what is wrong with his approach, which is not simply a matter of the scholarly errors we excuse and pound. I begin by summarizing some features of the original, which one would want to show through in the English. So basically, he's criticizing Binner, who doesn't know Chinese, for looking at a bunch of other translations of Laozi and then coming up with his own reading of what's going on. And I just think that Graham is an amazing stylist, so I'm going to continue. Certainly a successful rendering of Laozi requires more than sinological expertise. The compulsion it exerts is a matter of style as much as of thought. If indeed one can think of the style as separable from the thought. It is very short, this is the Tao Te Ching, by Chinese standards as well as our own, a loosely strung series of aphorisms grouped in stanzas which are always highly rhythmic and often rhymed. The text which tradition has preferred is pruned to a degree of terseness unusual even in Chinese writing, sometimes at the cost of syntactic ambiguity. It is in the essence of the style that the writer presents, asserts, and without explanation moves on, juxtaposing aphorisms so that parallels and contrasts explode in the imagination, and then, with a crucially placed therefore, proceeds to new pronouncements, which one perceives to be related, but to which there are any number of possible bridges. It appeals to that kind of intelligence which is at the opposite pole from intellect, not simplifying, clarifying, filling in all steps, but plotting the focal points in a complex of thought and leaving it to the reader to make his own jumps across the gaps. One wonders whether anyone in the history of literature has set out to say so much in so few words, to pick that minimum of gnomic utterances which will start the widest variety of readers thinking in the author's direction along their own paths. And I just love the alliteration he uses, the P's. And so the style is just incredible of A.C. Graham's writing. But I also think that his point is incredibly important, which is that there's a kind of thinking where you actually don't connect anything up. You provide pointers, pieces of evidence, signposts maybe, and you let the reader do it himself or herself. And I would say that this is probably also a feature of literature rather than philosophy as we typically think of it if we are coming from a kind of Western education. But I think this kind of reasoning, which you might call inductive or possibly even abductive in the language of the American pragmatist philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, whom I won't get into today because I have to admit that I don't fully understand it, but I'm really interested in a strand of science and philosophy which argues in this way. And I want to say that two people who are very near and dear to my way of thinking, who, just to name them, are Charles Darwin and Thomas Kuhn, that's K-U-H-N. You may be aware from my Twitter that I am very interested in Kuhn's way of reasoning, that essentially this form of scientific logic is a narrative one, and that this kind of narrative applies not just to evolutionary biology and paleontology, but that it can be extended and used in many other ways. So I'm not going to say too much more about that today, but just leave it as an open point that I think there is a kind of strange through line from anti-rational Chinese philosophy through Darwin and Thomas Kuhn to today. And that this strand, if it can be called that, is really important for what we believe and how we see the world. And one way that it's connected is that it puts emphasis on the fact that categories, labels, words, which are often the very subject of Western philosophy, especially in the 20th century, you get to a point where it seems to be all about language more than it is about experience or, I was going to say, phenomena. Of course, there is a continental European strand of philosophy which is directly concerned with phenomenology, but large sections of Anglo-American philosophy after the American pragmatists, about which potentially more later, tends not to go down that route and tends to stay, I was going to say, mired in language, which is shows some of my biases and probably why I like Taoism and why I like certain other of these thinkers. A short way of putting this position might be as a question, which is, why should we expect nature to conform to categories that are created in human language or in human thought? Darwin had this problem when he was trying to define what actually is a species and how do you know when something has speciated. And it's kind of more of a spectrum than it is any kind of like binary yes or no. So he spends a lot of time looking at this issue. And I think I'm going to leave it there today, even though that's a rather odd combination of thinking, and read to you a poem from John Keats, which should hopefully form some kind of counterpoint to what I've just been arguing. The poem is called When I Have Fears That I May Cease to Be. London, where I'm based, is starting to open up a little bit, and I saw this posted on public transport somewhere. So here's the poem. When I have fears that I may cease to be, before my pen has gleaned my teeming brain, before high-piled books in charactery, hold like rich garners the full ripened grain. When I behold upon the night's starred face huge cloudy symbols of a high romance, and think that I may never live to trace their shadows with the magic hand of chance. And when I feel, fair creature of an hour, that I shall never look upon thee more, nor have relish in the fairy power of unreflecting love, then on the shore of the wide world I stand alone and think, till love and fame to nothingness do sink. And I love this poem for many reasons. One is that it's about the fear of not getting everything you could out of your brain, which Keats, who died at 25, most certainly did not, given the trajectory of his poetry up to that point. But it's also in interesting tension with the Taoist point, which is that words do not in any way exhaust reality. They don't even really get anywhere near it. And yet, poetry does, doesn't it? And so I think there's this interesting tension. I am someone who immerses himself in words. I love literature. I love poetry. I am struggling to write. Sometimes I actually succeed, but most times I've failed, at least this year. And I think there's something really beautiful and powerful about Keats's fear of death before he loves and before he writes. I think it is just very close to home for me. And yet at the same time, he stands alone on the shore of the wide world. And by standing there and thinking, love and fame sink to nothingness. So it's almost like this apprehension of reality itself makes both desire for love and desire for fame seem insignificant. There's something sublime about it. And so the poem starts in a very un-Taoist place because it's all about getting words out of your brain. But in the end, it comes to something quite Taoist, which is that living is something more than either speaking or much more so than writing. So I will leave it there. I am Brian Kam. You can find me at briankam.com. or at Brian Kam on Twitter. And thank you for listening to this second experiment.